Thanks, Rory.
Great. Maybe I'll come around here. Is that all right?
Yep.
I'll stand up. Is that imposing? Well, great to be able to be with you guys this morning at Breakfast Club. I take it everyone's got to be at work by 8, so we'll finish before then, and then if you don't need to be, you can hang around, I guess. Is that right? Yes. Excellent. Well, yeah, really glad to think with you about work-life balance. I'm going to be kind of diving into scriptures occasionally, but also kind of riffing more broadly, and so we won't work systematically through the passage, but we'll rate it at particular times. So think about work-life balance, and perhaps you've noticed what I've noticed, that busy has become kind of a ubiquitous, even a default descriptor of how life is. So I've had conversations where, you know, there's the conversation where you say, how are you? Busy. Then even the conversation where people answer the question for you and say, how are you? You must be busy. Or even people are so sick of it that they're how are you apart from busy? Because the descriptor of busy has become like this compulsory acquisition. So I wanted to think about a bit about that before we hit on to work-life balance. So firstly, my question was, is that true? So people say they're busy. Is it actually true that people are busy? And it turns out kind of both yes and no. So empirically, it does seem to be that we're busier on certain measurements. So on average, work hours in Australia have increased in the last 30 years. They are up. And I think probably more pertinent to the feeling of busyness is that productivity is up. And so you think the measure of how much you work in terms of hours is one thing, but the measure of how much you're getting out of any one of those 1 hour is another thing. And however they measure these things, productivity is up. And then if productivity is up, sleep is also down. So there's a weird thing is that we are sleeping, so this is in the UK, in 1910, people slept for an average of 9 hours a night, and now that's down to 7.04 hours per night. And so we're just kind of getting 2 hours less sleep than you did in 1910. Perhaps if you were around in 1910, you can tell us about that afterwards and what it felt like. So maybe we work longer and work harder and sleep less. And if all those things are true, if we work harder, if we sleep less, and if we work longer, then of course we feel busy. But I think the picture is more kind of more nuanced than that. So there are particular things about the way that we live that we have a real or perceived busyness. One of them is the way children are reared. So there's been a massive measurable increase in the amount of extracurricular activities kids are involved in, and a kind of arms race amongst parents as to which kid can do their violin while they're also learning Japanese and doing yoga, etc. And so that's put a lot of demand onto weekends. And so things I'm religious, a church pastor, and there's been a massive, like, 15-year decline in church camps. So it used to be churches would always go away on camps, and that was just a standard thing. It really doesn't happen anymore, mainly because of those extracurricular things. And also occupational health and safety. So it turns out these days you can't run around barefoot and get your uncle to cook the food and all that kind of thing. But anyway, those are factors, the way we run our weekend. So there's an op-ed, a famous op-ed by Tim Kreider in 2012, and he talks about the situation where he asked, this guy in New York, asked a friend whether they can catch up over the weekend, do you want to do something? And the friend said that he didn't have a lot of time, but if something was going on, to let him know, and maybe he could ditch work for a few hours. And this is the quote: "I wanted to clarify that my question had not been a preliminary heads up on some future invitation. This was the invitation. But busyness was like some vast churning noise through which he was shouting at me, and I gave up trying to shout back over it." It's quite a powerful statement, don't you think? The busyness was this vast churning noise, and these friends were trying to shout over the top of it and eventually gave up. I think that's kind of vaguely terrifying, if that's what's happening, that we can't hear each other over the busyness. Now, where I want to say there is an empirical truth to us being busy in the last 30 years, I also want to pull back from that and say that's a bit more nuanced. So, for example, we're the first generation in human history that don't really need to be busy. We could actually get away with working a lot less than we work. I don't know, does anyone know the Maynard Keynes essay, the essay to his grandchildren? his grandchildren are alive, and he was, you know, the Keynesian economics, that he's that economist, and he wrote an essay in the 1930s about what work would be like in 2000, and lots of it was very prescient. It's an amazing essay. He really did understand a lot of where the economy was going, but he also predicted that we'd work an average of 15 hours a week in the year 2000, and that didn't happen. And our busyness is, when I say it's up in the last 30 years, we're busier than we were in the 1950s, but much less busy than the 1850s. So if you go back to the 1850s, work hours are much longer in the Industrial Revolution. The idea of having a two-day weekend, having 4 days, 4 weeks annual leave a year, getting long service leave, being able to go on international holidays and stuff, were unthought of. And yet, if you look at the 1850s, no one talks about busyness. So people talk about exhaustion, people talk about unfair work conditions, people talk about being tired and so on, but no one talks about busy. It's just not part of the narrative of the 1850s in a way it's part of our narrative. And so I think the problem for us is not just the quantity of our work, but the quality of our work, the nature of the kind of work that we're all involved in. If I can put it this way, I think one of the features of this, the last 20 years, the last 15 years, is that work is not just busy, but ambiguous. So your day could involve 20 minutes of watching cat videos on YouTube at 11 a.m., and 20 minutes of answering emails on the couch in your pajamas at 11 p.m. And I think one of the features, why the word busyness has risen up is partly because of the ambiguity about what anyone should be doing at any one time. Whereas if you're on the farm and then you're home, you can't plow in bed. Bed is for sleeping, the field is for plowing, the factory is where you work, and the house is where you rest, and that's ambiguous for us now. And so there's that lovely phrase about the vast churning noise of busyness, which I think is created by that ambiguity. Anyway, there you go. We can talk about that as an analysis, but I wanted to offer you five tools for thinking about work-life balance. So five ways to maybe claim back some work-life balance, if, as I take it, that's part of your vote by being here. So the first, some of these are conceptual tools and some of them are kind of practical tools. The first one is conceptual. I want to offer this to you. It's from that passage that Lainey just read about a time for everything and everything in its place. In the Bible, there are two words that we translate as the word time. But behind those two words, English has only got the one word, is the word chronos and the word kairos. And so the word chronos we have in our modern vocabulary, because we talk about chronology, and chronology has to do with when things happen in relation to other things. Chronos is the kind of time that is measured by clocks and calendars. It's now 7:30. In Greek, you'd say the chronos is 7:30, but you would never say the kairos is 7:30, because kairos doesn't mean the measured time, but appropriate time. So kairos is to say, this passage uses the word kairos in Greek, that there's a time for everything, and the time is not 7:30, the time would be it's breakfast time, or it's the weekend, or I just bumped into you, so clearly this is friendship time. And who here's lived in a not Western country? So tell me if this is the not Western situation that you're in. For example, like Indonesia, maybe not in the city so much, but you'll have people who are outrageously late for everything. And so you think, or in Africa, you think, what time am I supposed to, we're meeting at 12 o'clock or we're meeting at 2 o'clock and people rock up at 4 o'clock, like 2 hours late, no description or whatever of why they're late. And the mentality, so say the sociologists or the anthropologists, the mentality is not that people have been shabby with time, but people think fundamentally in terms of kairos rather than chronos. So the dominant measure is not that it's 7:30, but that it's breakfast time. And And if I'm walking to the bank for a meeting with the bank manager, but on the way I meet my cousin, then suddenly it's cousin time. And cousin time gets its allotted kairos before I then go to bank time. I don't know if that fits with any of the cultures that you've experienced. Does anyone want to testify? No? Anyone? Is it Germany that you're in? Someplace that's the exact opposite? Or? Okay. Yes, Tanzania would be a classic example of that. So what I want to do is offer you the idea of Kairos rather than Chronos. So he's got that there. There's a time for everything and every season, every activity under heaven, a time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to uproot. And what I want to say is I think we have to fight for Chronos. We have to fight for the idea that today is Saturday and it's a day off, or today is dinner time and so there's no, the iPhone has no place at dinner time because we're here to eat and to talk. We're not here to text and to run our schedules. And so one of the, I think the gifts biblical thought gives us is to think in terms of Kairos, in terms of what is this moment and therefore how do I be fully present in this moment for what this is, because we never have to be fully present in any moment, because you can be watching cats at 11 o'clock and you can be sending emails in the bath. So, Chronos and Kairos. The second one is, second tool for reclaiming work-life balance is to embrace the power of habit and to choose your habit. So the idea here is that humans are habit-forming creatures. You don't get to choose whether you have habits or not. You only get to choose between habits. So the idea of being habitless is just not a human option, and so you might as well choose the habits that will lead to better work-life balance. William James, the philosopher and psychologist, says this: there's no more miserable, and this is a while ago, so the references to tobacco, there's no more miserable person than the one in whom nothing is habitual but indecision, for whom the lighting of every cigar, the drinking of every cup of tea, the time of rising and going to bed every day, and the beginning of every bit of work are subjects of deliberation. And I think James is writing at the turn of the century, and I think for us that's been turned up to 11, that everything is a subject of deliberation, because the question of what should I be doing right now is one of the most stressful decisions that we face, and we face it all the time. And the power of habit is the power of working out that actually I'm going to do this now, and I'm going to repeatedly do this at this time now. And we talked about this at our church a little while ago, that your morning routine always has a habit, it's worth thinking, are those habits the habits that you want to shape your character and your way of being in the world? So if your first thing is to wake up and check your email or your Facebook on the phone, is that the habit that you want to form who you are? Or could you do better than that? Could you have a better routine in the morning, one that is more life-giving and more profound than just being across your email? Tool three for claiming back work-life balance is to plan for margin. One of the features of the life I'm describing is that we have little or no margin. Kevin DeYoung, the author, puts it this way: over the past year, I've come to see that I have planned no margin in my week, actually reverse margin. I look at my week, and before any interruptions come or any new opportunities arise or any setbacks occur, I already have no idea how I'm going to get everything done. If that resonates with people. But the idea here is to plan for margin, to make sure that what you've got in your week also includes the idea that not everything happens in the time that you've allocated for it, and not everything happens as easily as you thought it would, and that life does keep happening. Things keep coming in and interrupting you. And by allowing for margin, you deal with what is, I guess, the technical definition of stress. So I think the technical definition of stress is, you can do this on a whiteboard, where demands are greater than resources. So you think demands greater sign resources equals stress. Now, that could be real or perceived. It could be that you've got less resources, you've actually got less resources, or you feel like you've got less resources and you've actually got a lot of demands, or you feel like you've got a lot of demands. But that combination is what leads to stress. And I think the answer to that is to have margin to allow space for those resources to meet demands. Tool number four is to embrace the power of scheduling. This is more of a hack, I think. Given that we're also run by our diaries, we might as well use our diaries to help us get back to a better work-life balance. So your two options there is to like not use a diary, or to only use a diary for work and to not use it at home. And maybe you can do that. I can't. I find I'm so addicted to and shaped by my diary that I have to get my diary to tell me when my work-life balance kicks in and when it's time to rest. And so I think it's good to look at your diary and think, does this diary reflect any sort of, or this calendar, any sort of work-life balance? Does it have that kind of pattern of here's time that, and I see that my Google Calendar or my Mac, my Apple Calendar is telling me that this time is set aside, but it's not set aside for a meeting or a project, but set aside for rest or for exercise or for that sort of margin. I think I find at least that to hack my life properly, I need to be able to make those deals with myself. Every yes is a no, and every no is a yes, and I think that's important, especially if you're down the kind of people-pleasing end of things, to think that when you say, yes, I will go to that thing that evening, or go to that thing early, or be at that thing over lunch, you're also saying, no, I won't rest that night, or no, I won't be kind to the kids because I'll be super grumpy and I'll be parenting onto them the frustrations with my boss, or I'll be deciding not to see friends on the weekend because I've done these things. And so I think the power of scheduling is the power of being able to look at your calendar and have it tell you, actually, you're not available then, even though the reason you're not available is because you're reading a book in the bath or doing whatever it is that you do. Okay, the fifth and final tool for bringing back work-life balance is a specifically religious idea, which is the idea of Sabbath. And I'm going to finish with this one. There's a famous article in 2003, so a long time ago, in the New York Times, and Judith Shulevitz wrote an article called Bring Back the Sabbath. I don't know if anyone's read or come across this article. And she tells the story about how she, who's a secular Jew, found herself in her late 20s doing something she never imagined she'd do. She started going back to synagogue. And so she's secular, her beliefs in God or her non-belief in God hadn't changed, but she started going back to synagogue sheepishly and tentatively. But for her, she says something about the pattern of the endless output of a 20-something professional in New York made her crave what the Sabbath had offered. This is quoting from her. In the Darwinian world of the New York 20-something, everything, even socializing, reading, or exercising, felt like work or the pursuit of work by other means. I think that's quite kind of a profound and aids and abets my first point. In the Darwinian world of the New York 20-something, everything, even socializing, reading, or exercising, felt like work or the pursuit of work by other means. So for Shulevitz, the problem wasn't working hard. It was that you're never not working, because the scene of a 20-something in New York is endlessly competitive, endlessly busy. And so for her, going back to synagogue was her rebellion, her kind of finger sign to the modern world, and her way of claiming back something that's real. Now, she kind of gets reflective on this because she does find her way back into a kind of religious Jewishness, having come out of a secular upbringing, because her discovery, at least, was that the religious imperative was necessary for overcoming what we talked about before, the the endless churn of modern busyness. She describes it like this. She says, most people mistakenly believe that all you have to do to stop working is not work. The inventors of Sabbath understood that it's much more complicated. You cannot downshift casually and easily in the way you might slip into bed at the end of a long day. As the cat in the hat says, it's fun to have fun, but you have to know how. And she gives this long description of how, for her at least, the religious community of the synagogue, the scriptures, the pattern of prayer, and so on, were all necessary for her to leverage out of the churn of modern working life. Let me conclude with this. Shulevitz, this is where I want to go spiritual on you as we finish. She finishes the article with this. She says, not only did drudgery, this her talking about embracing Sabbath, not only did drudgery give way to festivity, family gatherings, and occasional worship, but the machinery of self-censorship shut down too, stilling the eternal murmur, the internal inner murmur of self-reproach. I think that's really profound. The machinery of censorship shut down, stilling the eternal inner murmur of self-reproach. I guess for her, the Sabbath was something that wasn't just biological or communitarian, but also spiritual. The inner murmur of self-reproach got a chance to be switched off. And this is where Christianity, I think, addresses something that is really profound in us, is that Jesus, in the New Testament, talks about Sabbath, but he talks about himself as the fulfillment of the Sabbath, as the one Jesus once said to his the people around him, come to me and I will give you Shabbat, I will give you rest. And he didn't mean I will give you one day and seven off, as wise as that might be. What he meant was I'll give you rest from the eternal murmur of self-reproach. Because Jesus, in his death, at the end of his suffering on the cross, says, it is finished, which I think means more than chronos. It means more than, oh, it's time for me to go. He means kairos, the moment is finished, the moment where humanity has to live with that eternal question of, am I good enough for anyone or anything? And where, according to the Christian gospel, Jesus provides us the spiritual rest to which our earthly rest is kind of a pointer, the rest of knowing God's approval.